You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Hi, and welcome to The Compass, the podcast documenting the struggles of life as an artist. I'm Leah Walsh.
My guest today is Marcus Crawford Guy. Marcus is a great actor who went to Juilliard after me. We were never there together, but we met a few years ago when we were both asked to do a workshop with the Center for Innovation in the Arts at school. We got to create these pieces with full access to all their interactive technology in the new black box space there. He's a really thoughtful artist with a unique point of view, and you can check out his work at marcuscrawfordguy.com. On a different note, Frankie and I are moving apartments this weekend, so wish us good luck. I'm very excited. We're going to be on the top floor at this new place, so I can start recording at home again. I haven't really been able to have guests over for the podcast because I've been working during the day, and at night the kids upstairs are running rampant and it sounds like a whole soccer team up there. So I'm very excited about that. I hope you enjoy the 115th episode of The Compass. What do you do to try to keep from going to the dark side as an artist?
Exercise has become the thing recently that's really helpful.
Yeah.
To like keep energy moving in my body rather than sitting in the feeling. Exercise has become the thing that keeps me buoyant in a way that I never thought it would be.
Is what made you see it in a new light?
I guess I had been running for a long time, and then my knees got sore, and so then I stopped and didn't realize that was the thing that was negatively affecting my like thought processes and when I was getting destructive and looking at what people I'd went to school with were doing instead of focusing on what I could be doing for myself. And then I took a CrossFit HIIT class.
Oh my goodness.
And found it to be so exhilarating and like competitive. Like I could choose how competitive I wanted to be with the people around me. They did not need to participate in my competition. I could just like take heavier weights than them, put my own work rate in relation to theirs without them knowing. And it exercised that energy out. And I've been doing it for 5 months now.
And wow.
It's money that initially I was like, oh, why is this leaving my account? And now that transaction goes and it's like, okay, game time.
Well, one, it holds you to it. Like then you have to do it if you've already paid for it. Because I've been doing the same thing with ClassPass and it's horribly expensive, but I kind of look at it as like a mental health budget.
Yeah.
Because it really does help me.
And it's like better than coffee. If I go early in the morning, I don't need the coffee so soon. Which means I don't get the like tragic come down.
So you mentioned maybe comparing yourself a little bit, but what does the dark side usually look like for you?
The dark side is me on IMDb Pro seeing what other people have done, and then it always circles back to me thinking about what would have happened had I not chosen to come to America. Because the path to employment would have been so much easier in terms of, not necessarily that I am a superstar actor who would have booked, but I do find myself signing in at auditions. I have to declare my immigration status, which... Right.
So people know that before they even see your audition.
Yes. And I have had a couple of instances where that's been spoken about before I've gotten to show my work. And I know that back home that would not have been the case. I'm sure in London people would have rolled their eyes at me being Scottish, but but yeah, that's definitely the dark side for me, is going, it's the path towards regret.
Right.
Yeah.
If you had made different choices.
Yeah.
What can we talk, just to give people a little bit of a picture of your path? Why did you choose to stay after Juilliard? And to, like, what do you see as the industry back home? Like, what sorts of opportunities would have been available there, do you think? Is it just like an issue of scale? Like, there's just so much more being made here.
I mean, I stayed after Juilliard because I moved here right after my 18th birthday, and I learned how to be an adult here.
Right.
And kind of sacrificed a lot of friendships and whatnot to be here for 4 years. And so my life felt like it was growing rootsier, and it just didn't, it was certainly an option to go home, but it didn't feel like, I don't know, it didn't feel like it would, it felt like I'd go back to square one going back home. There was this sense of like, oh, I will have to go and in some way like make up for the 5 years that I've been gone.
Right. Well, that's what I kind of felt about, like, moving to LA after school. I was like, well, all our connections are in New York. All the directors we've worked with, casting directors we've met.
Yeah.
That sort of thing.
And then in terms of opportunity back home, the week that I moved here, I guess in the UK, school starts like a month later. So I moved here, and then within that week, I got offered placement at a school in London with like a full ride. But I was...
You didn't find out until you'd already moved?
Until I'd moved, yeah. I came off the wait list. And that had initially been like, if this comes through, it's like government subsidized. It's
right, like financially.
Yeah, I'm not going to think about it. my dad's not going to let me think about it. He's going to pack my cases. I was here.
Yeah.
And I just think in terms of like coming out of a prestigious institution back home, being Scottish, I do think that I would have been, I mean, I was the only Scottish person here, but there are so few Scottish actors that get trained south of the border that I would have been seen, and I would also have been employable. Right now I'm definitely one of very few, but I often come up against, oh, you don't have a green card, so, and it's actually much easier sometimes for, especially in television, it's much easier for producers to buy someone who's in the UK a visa for a certain amount of time than it is to take my visa, which is independently held, meaning I can work for several employers.
Mm.
For some reason, the networks don't like that. It gives me autonomy. And if they buy someone's visa, they are held to that network, which I understand it from like
a complicated
capitalist.
And not useful for an actor.
Yeah, it's not helpful for me having to like make rent.
Right, and when you're somebody who's living here and contributing to the economy here and invested in the city, you know, like, why not employ you?
Yeah.
How frustrating.
And again, that's a conversation that's not coming up when it's like decision time. That's a conversation that comes up before my work has even been seen.
Right.
Which is when it's really even more frustrating, because it's then like a subheading under which everyone sees my work.
Or it's hanging over you when you're trying to just think about the audition, which is hard enough. Yeah. It's hard enough. Have you found any different ways of dealing with that situation in the years since you've gotten out of school?
Yeah, I mean, I'm now at a point where most people know that I'm Scottish, but if I'm meeting someone for the first time, I use my American dialect because anything to throw people off the scent is helpful.
That's interesting.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really silly thing to say, but like, we're actors, and if you can convince someone of something, that's like helpful in proving that you're good at the job.
Yeah.
So,
I mean,
and there are a couple.
It must be annoying that you have to do that, but
it's annoying, but
if
it's also
helps get around that roadblock. Then
yeah, and also, I think I've taken enough like casting workshops now that I like. I'm like, it's their job is to find the best fit for the role. And so if I can come in and pitch myself as something closer to that ballpark, then I should do that without like costuming myself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But how about any like mental, like to make it mentally
I mean,
more palatable?
It's just something I've grown used to. When I got issued my last visa, my lawyer, when I got back to the US, she was like, come and visit me in my office. And I was like, that sounds horrible. And she gave me a list of the requirements for a green card, like what makes you eligible. And she was like, carry this around everywhere with you. And just like, always do something every day that moves you towards this permanent resident status. And that's been really helpful for when I feel destructive and like,
yeah,
I'm not making forward movement, to like pull out that list and go, okay, well, I've done enough teaching now, and I have presented at different places, and if I can get verification of that, or if I can use that as leverage to get more work of a similar nature, that all goes in the file for that long-term goal.
Right. You need a lot of documentation, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's just lots of paper with people using superlative language. What's kind of tragic about it is that oftentimes it's more important that the people recommending me are prestigious and established than it is that I am important in any way. So, yeah. And I've grown to see that it's like, there's something humorous about it, especially in the current political climate, that I'm like,
yeah,
desperately trying to stay here while
other people are making jokes about trying to move to Canada every day.
Yeah.
Yeah, that must be strange.
There's like a really sick irony in there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just because I'm wondering if this is helpful to anyone else who might be in this position.
Yeah.
Like, are there any resources that you've found kind of working through all of the rules and laws and stuff since you graduated that has been helpful to you?
Just to be transparent with people about what you need. I think people in New York are just like inherently busy.
Mm-hmm.
And I left everything to the last minute and then was not clear with what I needed.
You mean last minute, like when
last
you graduated?
Last minute in terms of trying to pull together documentation so that I wouldn't need to go home and wait for things to process.
Right.
And for the record, I spent 7 months at home waiting. When I got back to the US, before I took any job, I always made it 100% clear that I was going to need some kind of proof of the fact that this had happened. And if I felt any kind of resistance towards that, I started to make contingency plans of like, oh, Broadway World will write about this, and they will write about it even if I have to ask them
right
to. Or finding other ways to acquire that documentation if the person who was employing me directly wasn't willing to testify to that. But yeah, being on, having that be a forethought rather than an afterthought has been empowering, because now at the point when I'm reapplying for a visa, I already have so many things checked off the list that I'm not intimidated by it.
Right, and if people are so busy that, you know, if you worked with them 6 months ago, it's much less likely that they're going to take the time to write the thing for you.
Yeah, and it probably wasn't important to them in the same way that it was important to me.
Of course.
Yeah, and I've grown to, like, sympathize with that.
Besides the career stuff, do you find New York to be somewhere that you find inspiring, that you think you want to, like, make a life here long term? New York itself?
I'm not sure. So when I grew up in a village where, like, by the shape of my face, people knew my last name. I was a guy boy. From, I mean, people I still don't know to this day. They would see me at church and walking down the street, and you're Ian Guy's grandson. Yes. So the thing that's always appealing to me in New York is getting on the train and being anonymous.
Mm-hmm.
That's fascinating to me, that there are more people in this city than there are in the country that I come from.
Wow.
That's amazing to me. And I feel so comfortable being on the train and doing all the stuff that we as actors need to do, and walking down the street and talking to myself because I know there's someone four steps behind me doing the same thing. I love the anonymity here. And I love that. I think the thing that I prefer here versus Los Angeles is that there's still interpersonal connection. Like, I'm walking into people, I'm apologizing to them or asking them to apologize to me. Yeah, I think the car culture out west it's very different. Yeah. I'm someone who's always been outdoorsy, and even if that's walking
concrete.
Down the street, even if it's concrete, like,
right.
It's still
right. I like knowing that if I had to, I could get there on my feet.
Yeah,
you know.
Yes.
If it really,
yeah, it might take me 2.5 hours, but
I could. Can we talk about your teaching?
Yes.
You're doing a ton of stuff right now with Artists Striving to End Poverty.
Yeah.
When did that start for you?
That started, well, it was interesting because I'd heard about it all throughout my time at Juilliard, but it was one of those things that I never took the time to research. I guess I'd always been like, at some point in time, someone will talk to me about this, and
right.
No one did. And then when I was at home for 7 months, I, like, did the research and filled out the volunteer application and immediately started volunteering, like, 2 weeks after I got back. And that was a game changer for me in terms of seeing parts of New York that I wouldn't otherwise see. But also, my very first A-Step workshop, I went in the classroom and I was talking about me as an actor and some of my goals, and I said I'd love to be on Broadway, and this kid turned around and looked at me and was like, what, the street outside? And we were in, like, East New York, and I was like, oh, I'm here living some kind of gold-plated dream, and I'm looking survival square in the eye. And that was incredibly sobering and made me let go of this, like, chokehold that I had on auditioning and, like, I must. And I started to check my privilege. And I had been teaching quite a bit before that, but the A-Step work is just so specific because you're dealing with non-traditional classrooms. At the moment, I'm working in a juvenile detention center, and that's sobering, but also, like, just such a... It makes... I reflect for hours when I come out, working with young people who are so vibrant and spirited and inherently, like, much more creative than I am, but who have made life choices that will keep them in the system for the rest of their life. And I can't help but be thankful that I was born in that, like, small village where sheep outnumber people, because I just was never raised to see the kind of things that I'm sure these kids saw and then did.
Right. Or the positions they were put in.
Yeah. It's just so... They probably would see more people in a day than I would see in a week. And the rate at which they experience things is just vastly different from my own.
So you said you had done quite a bit of teaching before you started with ASTA?
Yeah.
What kind of teaching was that?
I took over a program in Central Florida called START, which was established by another Juilliard graduate, Evan Todd.
Oh, yeah.
And that was like a two-week summer arts workshop that grew into like a secondary program called The Road to College, which is all about focusing high school students that want arts careers, because there is a specific application process for art schools, but no one tells us about it in high school. And then if that is your chosen path, you're like, wait, it's October of my senior year and I need 4 monologues.
Right.
3 months from now. And if you don't have the resources, then all of a sudden the dream has to sit on the back burner.
Right. So that was more for kids who were already interested in the performing arts.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then with the A-step work, you're kind of teaching other things using the arts.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'd hate to describe it.
Yeah, I'd hate to it, but
I'd hate to describe it as a
such
distraction, but there is this sense of, like, today we're going to learn to cooperate with one another by...
Those are important skills.
Yes. Flashback to, like, being on the subway and watching people try and navigate the doors opening and closing.
Yeah.
Yeah, the work is just, like, endlessly powerful. I worked with the International Rescue Committee last summer, and that was just crazy to be in a classroom with 18 kids, many of whom do not have a common language with each other, never mind with me, and to begin to try and teach a class that everyone can participate in. And I had so many grand plans for what we would do in this storytelling class, and it became like an hour of Mad Libs. We, like, taught all of these different words and then would play Mad Libs and then we would act out the Mad Libs, because we had constructed, like, all of this gesture work related to each word that could possibly come up. And that felt, if I had told myself last July that was all I would achieve, I would have been like, you're a failure. Don't do this. But it felt really triumphant to watch kids on stage acting out their Mad Lib in a new language.
No, and to find, like, a common language in the gestures and everything. That's great.
Yeah. Yeah. It was so special.
Yeah. No, it definitely, I mean, I know it's hard to hang on to that all the time when you switch back to, like, career mode when you have a day where you're going to auditions or something.
Yeah.
But you hope that perspective carries with you into the room, and you can put things a little less on a pedestal or on the high wire when you walk in there.
Yeah, I do try and, as cheesy as it sounds, I do try and think about my students who would long to be in the waiting room mm-hmm. that I am in before an audition, as a way of settling anxiety. Because that's the big thing for me, is I go in the room and all I see are my nerves in front of me, and
right.
half the time I come out and I'm like, I wish I could reflect on that audition, but I was so not present that that's not even a possibility.
Yeah.
And reflecting on work that's actually so much hard, it is so much harder to be in a secure facility working with young offenders. Like, that is a much, much harder task than memorizing words and going in a room and regurgitating them with a sense of truthful experience.
It's crazy though how much your body can take over in those moments though. I've battled with that as well.
Yeah,
I mean, like, why, like, I feel good, I know what I'm doing, why is my hand shaking? Like, I have no control over
yeah
that.
Yeah,
it's bizarre. What does your family make of your choice to be an artist for your career?
Well, it's funny, my parents are both not artistic at all.
Yeah.
My mom will flinch at that. She'll be like, I can draw. but my brother and I are both artists. My brother is a design engineer who works for Apple.
He's older or younger?
Older. Fiercely intelligent.
Hmm.
And just really, really smart and creative in a much more practical way.
Right.
I certainly have the, like, wandering brain. Like, lots of unfinished projects on my MacBook that I hope never dies.
How do you handle that distance, that long distance between you and your family?
You know, it's funny, because when I was young, I could never do, like, I couldn't even do sleepovers.
Really?
I would, like, stay until, like, 10:30, and then I'd be like, I'm tired, so I need to go home. And I guess when I came to Juilliard, I felt, like, for the audition, I felt like this was a place where I would be supported even when I was struggling. And I cried several times during the audition process and felt nurtured, which made that transition easier. I remember I've never been more scared in my life than when my dad left me before I'd, like, unpacked my room. He was like, I'm gonna go because you need to, like, do this on your own. And that was terrifying. But then we made an agreement that regardless of how homesick I got, no one would visit me before the end of the semester, and I would not under any circumstance go home. And that was hard, and at times I was so lonely because I had very few things that felt familiar around me, and I had to, like, plug in my webcam to my old laptop and, like, pray that Skype would work.
Right.
But it's gotten easier. And now my brother lives in San Francisco, so he's the same distance away in the other direction. And this is home now. And when I was in Scotland in 2015 waiting on my visa processing, I felt homesick for New York in a way that I never felt homesick for Scotland.
Mm.
I was longing for the freedom to be able to jump on the subway and go somewhere, and even if it was only to kill time, knowing I can do that in New York is really amazing. And I know people are listening going, but in Scotland there are, like,
I want to green go to your fields village
and yeah, like, no,
I understand
no that. Trespass laws, blah blah blah.
I think you can still love both. I grew love. Up in the country, and I miss aspects of it, and then when I'm there, I miss things about the city, and
yeah,
each are better if you get away often.
Yeah. I remember also, I guess because sometimes I do go like 9, 10, 11 months without seeing my parents, I remember going home and being like, oh, people got like slightly older, and that was slightly terrifying to just be like, I am not away having accumulating all of these experiences, and like time stops, mm-hmm. it like continues for everyone, and that's I'm sure only going to get harder as time passes.
Yeah I know that you've been very involved in like doing multidisciplinary work.
Yes.
I don't know if that's the right word. And we had first kind of spent time together, yeah. when we did that project here. What did they call it?
Beyond the Machine.
Was that part of Beyond the Machine, or was it called something else? I guess it was. The CIA.
So. Oh, yeah.
What does that stand for?
The Center for Innovation in the Arts.
That's right, yeah. Which, you know, was projects involving technology and stuff.
Yeah.
What sort of things are you excited about right now with, like, non-traditional ways to use your skills, or collaborations that you're interested in, or stuff like that?
Well, I'm always interested in the fact that everyone always asks me if I'm a dancer, and like I'm always interested in work where I can be moving as a dancer, and I don't know, the stuff that, I guess my issue with the project that we did here, which was so creatively fulfilling, was to then try and move that project and like have a conversation about how do I try and self-produce this, and just hear how much insurance would cost on like a single piece of technology.
Right. I don't know if they've advanced that since we did it, but that was a flaw, I think, in the idea.
I was like,
because Jenna and I had the same thing.
Yeah, I was like, I don't know if I want to insure like a $12,000 right. electric xylophone.
Right. It was cool to like be given these tools to play with, but then it's like, well, how do we take this beyond the workshop? Like,
yeah.
Since we don't own them.
Yeah. So that's been like the stumbling block there. At one point I had dreamed up this idea of like creating a digital piece that was like 24 hours on Twitter, where every minute you would take the like top trending topic and the first tweet that comes up and just like have dramatic readings of them to like document 24 hours in the world, where someone doing the most asinine thing can become
amplified.
Yeah. There was a story about a woman who, she tweeted something really silly and irresponsible about AIDS before she got on a like 17-hour flight to South Africa, and then she turned on her phone when she arrived in Johannesburg, and she had been, the internet had like eaten her alive and spat her out and moved on. But she was not aware that that had happened, and I remember hearing that story and being like, that's interesting that we'll, it's like vultures.
It's so fast.
But yeah, the thing that I loved about that project was that I am such a technophobe that Ed Billows really made me interface with the technology and get to know it. And I totally recognize its value in the theater. And I'm glad that we got that like one-on-one time with artists behind the scenes and like really were performer, producer, collaborator, right. designer.
Because usually if those kinds of elements are in a production, like the director and the designers are just dealing with them, you're just told where to move.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And that was really interesting. I remember making requests and them being like, this is like man-made technology. So while it can do lots of things, it can't do what you want it to do. And me being like, but they told me I could do anything.
Use my imagination. Yes.
But I enjoy making my own work. I like writing. Last year I self-produced a short film just to like see if it was possible. And I did it on almost no money. And that was really exciting, and that's been a relationship and a project that's grown very quickly into like a, dare I call it, a pilot script.
Oh yeah.
I mean, I think writers would slap my wrist, but
we have to start somewhere.
Yeah. So that's really exciting, and me and my collaborator Evan Margolis submitted it to Sundance for a lab because why not?
That's great.
And I think that's been really amazing to go like, where's the extreme that we could take this to?
Right.
And then you start to hold yourself to a higher standard.
Well, and it's great to have those things that you can work on with one other person or work on in your room alone when you're not cast in something.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's fun as well, because we wrote it and I was like, I am so in this, and I'm an actor, and I have written a part very clearly for myself. and then just like wishing up a way to make that happen.
Yeah.
And it's like at a point in time I didn't think that there would be a script, and now there is. So that tells me there's a way for me to make this and be in it.
And people are doing that. Like right now, I feel like especially is the time for that. People are writing their way into things.
And also to just be inspired by things that you see and then try and make something that's your own in a similar image. That's really exciting. Evan and I love like mockumentary stuff, like mm-hmm. The Office and Parks and Rec, and definitely feels like in television at the moment there's a gap there. I don't see the thing that's filled that space, and we were like, let's dream it up. And so the original short film is called Making David Harper's Actor Real, and it's about these two pushy parents who are just so proud of their talent-free son making his reel that they hire a documentary film crew to film the reel being filmed.
Oh my god.
And it's just like so many layers of like obnoxious rich white people. And it's like, I'm smiling. So it's it's joyous for me. Yes.
That's great. Is there a lesson you've learned in the last couple of years that you're really proud of that you want to tell me about?
I've learned that I don't need to be any version of anything that's ever come out of the Juilliard School in order to be successful. And I love this place with all my heart, but like, I'm no Oscar Isaac, and nor do I want to be. I'm Marcus Crawford Guy, and I think I have some really exciting and probably weird things to offer the world, but I spent like 2.5 years sitting on what's truly unique and wonderful about me, because I felt like there was a formula that I had to, to meet and fill. And lo and behold, as soon as I like took hold of the thing that's essential to me, which I think is like my strange and odd sense of humor, I'm auditioning better. I'm showing up in how I prepare my work and how I talk to myself before I go in the room, when I go in the room, and then like promptly tearing that stuff up and throwing it away and going, that was an opportunity for me. It was not me.
Yeah.
And I think you know, when you're 22 and you're out of Juilliard and like you get auditions for Broadway stuff and you think you're like the bee's knees, I would come out of those auditions and that would be the next 4 weeks of my life. That was naive me not realizing if this is going any farther, you will hear within the next four hours. And that's going to make a great story. But yeah, I'm really proud that
it's huge.
That I think I have something to offer that's not based on where I went to school.
Right.
Because if the Juilliard school was the be-all end-all, then someone would have came and saw me at my showcase and been like, this is it, that's click click, we're done.
You don't, like, need, you to don't grow need to anymore. Work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And actually at that point in time I was like so shrouded in training that the thing that was vibrant and sparkly about me was not ready to be showcased. It had really good tongue tip agility. And that was about it.
Yeah. Well, that is a huge, huge lesson. I would like to say that I've learned that as well. Some days more than others.
Oh yeah. I mean, I have days where I'm like, ugh.
but there's a weird pressure you put on yourself right when you graduate, which
just so unhealthy. It's so unhealthy. And I remember people give me such great advice and I was like,
Right. It's not necessarily that like the teachers are putting it on you or anything, although I'm sure there's some things about fourth year that obviously get it in your head, but you pick it up from other students or you just put the pressure on yourself from people who you see who are working. You're like, that's the only thing you can do.
But I remember one teacher who I did not have a particularly healthy relationship with pulled me aside before the showcase and immediately like my anxiety topped out at like a 17 out of 12. and she was like, you know that we're not worried about you. And I was like, whoa. And I didn't quite understand what that meant. And I think after the showcase, when I didn't get a good response, I felt like that was her way of letting me down gently, like, this will pay off at some point in time. But actually, I've been such a fiercely hard worker since the minute I got here that was her way of saying, like, if you keep going on the path that you're forging for yourself, there are only great things in store. But at the time, I was like, is this a...
What are you trying to do? Yeah. Are you trying to trick me?
I was so suspicious. And then I had other people that were like, 22 and 23 are going to be the worst years of your life. But when 24 comes, and then 24 came. It's magic.
And then nothing.
Yeah, my birthday's at like the start of the month, and I just paid rent. And I was like, I'm 24 and I have no money.
I'm ready. Where is it?
Yes. It was like, I was told there would be a pot of gold. And of course, my birthday cards are like stuck somewhere over the Atlantic. It was truly nothing.
Do you have any artistic mentors that you've found in your career that are important to your process?
You know, this is someone I've never met, but I think if I did ever meet Gillian Jacobs, I would probably like wash the floor in front of her so that she could step on it, because there is something about the, and I'm sorry to make this Juilliard centric, but about the way that she was able to move forward from that. That was when I read the like Lenny Letter article that she wrote. I was like, whoa, that's the path that I need to be on to empower myself. And that felt like huge. It felt like someone was speaking to me through my computer screen. And also she's such a like joyous comedian.
What I haven't seen a ton of her work. What do you really recommend of hers?
Love on Netflix, I just think it's genius. Okay. I think the way that like toxic behaviors, specifically addiction, is dealt with, and these two like painfully neurotic characters at different ends of the spectrum find a meeting place and like build a ground on which they both can walk is like so wonderful and powerful. And I'm sure other people are like, it's trash.
Well, that's the nice thing about art, it's subjective.
And yeah, it just finished, and I'm so
I have to watch it. I haven't clicked on it whenever I see it.
Yeah, I mean, it's called Love. It feels whimsical.
But it's nice when you hear somebody who's ahead of you on the path articulate something that you're feeling. You're like, oh, I'm not the only one.
Yeah, that's been amazing. And then I always, always, always felt like Moni Akeem was someone who just like was able to see me, mm-hmm. and was able to see the struggles that I was going through as an actor. To like, I had my like hard worker and like must get this correct, and then he was like, but the like improviser who is who is trained to make mistakes and fail is so much more interesting. And he was always so wonderful at celebrating my successes, because he knew that I would beat myself up over the failures. And yeah, I just think he was the first person I met at the school. He was in the room when I auditioned, and I remember going, you are so quirky, and like laughed at all the things that I never thought people would laugh at in my work. And I just think he understood my neuroses immediately.
Special man.
Yeah, so special. Yeah. So special.
And also just an incredible teacher.
Yeah.
I don't think I could ever be a teacher like that.
Yeah. And he listens. Yeah.
So two quick questions, and then we'll wrap it up. I know we talked about exercise earlier, but if you are having a day when you're feeling really uninspired and down, like, mm-hmm. are there any other concrete things that you reach for again and again, like books you reread or things you do?
I love reading Gertrude Stein, because I have like a book of her essays, mm-hmm. which I love because it's so hard to make sense of that I can't have anything else going on in my head. So it like undoes the knot. It's like uses that energy in another way. And then also taking myself to places where I have experienced extreme happiness and joy. Like the High Line. That was like the first place publicly in New York that I held a boy's hand, and like that just gives me great joy to like be there, because I'm like, I'm not with him anymore, but it was wonderful. Taking myself to a physical location where I was in a brighter spot, because my couch has seen it all.
I love that. Yeah, yeah. New York is interesting that way because it really is so small that like all of that history starts to overlap all the experiences. Yeah. Like whenever I come in Lincoln Center, I'm like experiencing 10 different years of my life at the same time. I love that. And then the final question is, have you seen anything lately that you want to recommend of any art form?
Ooh.
Yeah. Friends shows or anything.
I'm trying to think. Well, I saw Three Tall Women.
Oh, you
did? Yeah. And Glenda Jackson is just...
I want to see that.
Outrageous. She's so wonderful and so vibrant, and there's a really great lesson for us all in the fact that she like put down the work for quite some time and went and did something else, and now she has picked it back up again, and she is woof, like so exquisite.
I can see that.
And if anyone hasn't seen, I mean, this is older now, but if anyone hasn't seen Mr. Gaga, the documentary about Ohad Naharin.
Oh, I still haven't seen it. I do need to see
That's
that
really okay. something that...
Two very important things to put on my list.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, Marcus, thank you.
Thank you so much.
This was great. Thank you for listening to the Compass Podcast. If you find these conversations valuable to your life as an artist and would like to support the ongoing production of The Compass, please consider becoming a patron at patreon.com/thecompasspodcast. Pledges start at as little as $1 a month. You'll get access to bonus content, and anything you can give would be greatly appreciated. Also, if you have a moment, please rate or review in iTunes. Every little bit helps other listeners to find the podcast. I'd like to thank the following people for their generosity. The Compass cover art is by Kim Miller, music by Brandon Spieth, audio assistance from Nick Choksi, and a special thanks to Frankie J. Alvarez. See you next time.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Suffs. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Suffs celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Suffs has arrived on Broadway, and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suffsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.